Hey, John.
Hey, good timing.
Yeah, we got it right on the money here.
Yeah.
So, did you finish your Ty Cobb book?
Oh, yeah, I did that. Now I'm anxiously kind of sorting through things to try to find a book to read next. Quite often when you read a good book, it's sort of a letdown to try to find another one as good. But
Yeah, I have that problem.
But, yeah, I finished it up. It was... You know, like I said, it's might as well just talk a little bit about the book. Its book is called Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty by Charles Learson. It came out in 2015, New York Times bestseller. I guess when you take a look at biographies, particularly I've read a lot of baseball biographies, what separates this and makes this a good book, a very good book, is the fact that you learn as much about the person and the way he conducted himself and his mindset and his temperament. And you get a feeling that you really understood the man after you finish it, rather than trying to expound upon a lot of his achievements and going through a lot of game accounts where, you know, it's frustrating when you read a book about baseball and every page is just another account of a game. This one very strategically uses games to demonstrate his personality as much as anything. You know, the thing is, Ty Cobb has been written, there's been a lot of books written about Cobb. I personally have 11. And
wow,
read most of
that's
them.
A lot of books.
Yeah, but in, you know, he's... He wrote autobiographies as early as the 1920s, and then as we move into when he moves into the 50s, there's a couple of books about him. And Ty Cobb died in 1961, so usually, quite often, the death of a great baseball star such as him, that'll elicit more of written about him, including books, articles, etc. And unfortunately, Cobb got paired with a fellow named Al Stump to do his autobiography. And Stump was a person whose reputation was writing for magazines such as True Magazine. True hardly stated what the magazine was all about. They were more like adventure magazines. So the problem was that the autobiography that was written by him about him was filled with a bunch of embellishments at best, and more likely just flat out lies and misstatements. And what they did is that Cobb's autobiography came out. He was so upset about it that he tried to help fix it, but he died before he could. So as a result, the autobiography as told to Al Stump came out and just continued to reinforce a lot of these myths that we have about Ty Cobb. And so that sort of gives you a little bit of the background in terms of what's confronted. And, you know, it seems that what happens quite often is that later authors, such as there's a fellow named Charles Alexander, a professor at Miami University, wrote a book that was considered the authoritative book on Cobb. He went to secondary sources such as Stump's book basically what he does is he just perpetuates some of these things. So what are some of these?
I'm curious.
What are some of the myths? Myths that didn't exist in the myth breakers that take place. I think that the one thing in the book is that in Learson's book is that he emphasizes the fact that that Ty Cobb's attitude towards race, a lot of people consider Ty Cobb to be a racist. It seems so logical in terms of, you know, being from the South, being from Georgia. It kind of placed him in that situation when and one thing that's true, and that is Ty Cobb, there's no doubt, was a very short-tempered individual who would pick a fight in a heartbeat. So, you know, but the fact is that quite often some of these fights that he got into. Some of them were with, you know, with players. Some of them with fans. Some of them with just, you know, individuals he'd run into as he was going in hotels, et cetera, and, you know, people trying to do service for him. Fact is that quite often the people that were considered to be the ones that he was fighting with were in, were considered to be black. Well, this Charles's research has found that in most cases they weren't black. They were white. So and it was just assumed that because of their position in maybe a hotel. The hotel, you know, maybe there was a maintenance person in the hotel that Cobb had got off on the wrong foot with. They assumed the person was black, and he wasn't. So I think the biggest myth breaker is the fact that Cobb later on was a big proponent of the integration of baseball. Cobb also was very – clubs will quite often have mascots, and as demeaning as it might sound, Cobb was one of the players on the Detroit Tigers who their mascot, who was black, he befriended and actually got him jobs outside of baseball and helped him become a fairly well-to-do a person. So that was part of it. But another piece of this exercise is that there's this myth that Ty Cobb didn't get along with his teammates. And the fact is that most people figured that it was just because of his combustible nature caused that to happen. Well, as I read through the book, I realize that the owners of the Tigers realized very early that Ty Cobb was a very, very special individual in terms of his personality and the way that he conducted himself. He was a gate attraction. So as a result, the owners pampered him and treated him special. And the players resented the fact that Cobb was given a lot of special favors. Ty Cobb would report to spring training a month late. He would be allowed to actually train if he lived in Augusta, Georgia. If there was a team nearby training, he would train with them rather than training with his club. So the fact is that
wow. The
prima donna attitude, it's sort of like, and Cobb asked for a lot of special favors. He took off a week in the middle of the season to get married. Those were probably the two things is that he really wasn't that much of a racist, if at all. And two, that any of the bitterness he had with his teammates was basically because they were jealous of him because of the behavior he got. I mean, no player now would get the special treatment that Ty Cobb got by the Detroit Tiger owner. So that was a large part of it. Cobb was a very, very smart individual who traveled in the circles with not only, you know, sports figures, but also with the most prominent businessmen of the day, with politicians, et cetera, and a very smart individual. And I think one thing that's pretty well known already is that he, being from Georgia and Atlanta, he was very tight with Coca-Cola and got their stock early in the 20s. And then he's in Detroit, so he ended up being very close with the owners of General Motors and bought into those two stocks and rode them out through the Depression and ended up becoming a very, very wealthy person. So,
wow. A lot of people don't know that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the thing is quite often ball players, after they get done, they don't know what to do. Their whole life has been baseball. Cobb was able to transcend that and I always respect players that are able to take and move on to a new life and basically not be burdened or be, you know, have this, what do I do now? You know, it isn't a question of being poor. It's a question of what do I do with my life? What do I do with every day as I get up? You know, now that they've lost, you know, quite often their sports. So
right.
I totally
well, I think. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think the image of Ty Cobb, two things in popular culture anyway, you know, baseball historians aside for a second, in popular culture. The two things that form an opinion about Ty Cobb are Field of Dreams, when Ray Liotta's character, Shoeless Joe Jackson, pointed out that everybody hated Ty Cobb. He was an asshole.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is that book, you know, that terrible book that got made into a movie. You know?
Right. Yeah, and I mean, it just, the fact is, you know, one thing is to have a movie based upon a biography, the biography, and the Al Stump, the actual guy who wrote it, is included in the movie. But then you have the poetic license of the movie itself, which then allows you to further, through for dramatic effect, you know, add more of the inaccuracy to his story. Speaking of Joe Jackson, played by Ray Liotta, and in that movie Field of Dreams, Joe Jackson and Ty Cobb had a very, very good relationship. Ty Cobb actually considered Joe Jackson to be a much better, to be a better hitter than he was, and was not, and made that very clear, not only after he was done playing, but while he was playing. Joe Jackson was considered an extremely natural hitter, and quite often, when you take a look at, you know, the power players that came afterwards, the golden age of baseball in the 20s with Babe Ruth, where there was more home runs, many people consider Joe Jackson to be the forerunner, the one who basically set the tone that allowed that to happen, just to, based upon the way that he played. Ty Cobb was more of an individual who took advantage of, you know, his talents and utilizing them to the greatest in terms of hitting the ball where, you know, the players were in position, taking advantage of the fact that the fielders got real nervous when Cobb got on the field, because he was always, you know, jittery, bouncing around, energetic. He didn't know what the next thing he was going to do. So Cobb had a style that fit more with what they call the dead ball era of baseball that existed between 1900 and 1920, while Joe Jackson was just considered a natural. And there's a little incident in the anecdote in the book where Ty Cobb is going through Joe Jackson's hometown. You know, this is after they'd both, you know, retired. And Ty Cobb said, I got to stop by and talk to somebody here. So he went in, and Joe Jackson owned a liquor store, I think. He did fairly well after his baseball career was, you know, ended by the Black Sox scandal. And it was funny because Joe Jackson didn't acknowledge Cobb, and Cobb says, "Well, Joe, don't you know who I am?" He says, "Oh, I know who you are. I just figured you didn't know who I was." And it was just so the modesty that Jackson had. But they had an incredibly good relationship. So that's just another example of how they basically, interacted with each other. And the other thing about Cobb, and most players respected Cobb. I'm talking about not his teammates, but his opponents. And a lot of the myths about him, you know, sharpening his spikes before games so he could slice and dice players on the base paths, are totally inaccurate. He was an aggressive player. Would he get into a fight with a player, with an opponent? Yes. Would he get in a fight with an umpire? Yes, he would. But I think we have to remember that, you know, the fact is that it was more common for things to be, for disagreements to be settled quite often with having a more physical altercation than we see now. Usually now when we see altercations, they're because of emotion. Well, back then it would be like, I think we have a disagreement here. Maybe after the game we can get together underneath the stands and take care of this. In a very calm way, they'd say that, and they'd do it.
Interesting.
You know. I thoroughly, it was a very enjoyable read. And so, like I said, I totally recommend it.
Was it well written?
Paperback. Yeah, you know, the fact is that the author, one of the things you look for is you look for what the author's done before. The author has written a book about the history of Indy 500. He's been the editor of several publications like Sports Illustrated. And a couple of – the other thing is he's got he's written articles in, you know, the New York Times, Rolling Stone, Newsweek. So you look at his pedigree, and what's good about a pedigree about this guy, and I'll spell his name, it's Leershen, L-E-E-R-H-S-E-N, is that his background transcends sports. It transcends baseball. And quite often you it's nice to have somebody who's got a broader background when it comes to writing sports. There's another thing that I look for before I read a book. I look for, number one, his, you know, biographical information. Number two, I look for the acknowledgments. A book is not written in an island, on an island. A book is written through collaboration, through working with other people, having good mentors, having a good editor. And so looking for, you know, exactly the kind of support system that the author has that allows him to take his skills and make them as used as well as they can be is very, very important. So I think that pretty well tells the story.
I can see that. Yeah. It sounds like a great book. And
it would be something that even a person who's maybe not what you call, like me, baseball centric, but is interested in personalities, particularly in the 20s, of that era and on, would enjoy it.
So he frames it well. Historically, you can kind of feel the times as you're reading it.
It's
not just statistics and game recounting. It's the real deal.
Yeah, it talks more about as much off the field as it does on the field. I think you pretty well summarized it, is that we've got a book here where you do get a feel for the times, and more important, you get a feel for the person. Makes it a good book. So
cool. Yeah.
Yes.
Well. So how's everything else going? How are you feeling today? You get a good night's sleep?
I'm feeling pretty good. I sleep was probably not as good as the night before. It's a little, hour and a half, 2 hours here and there. But overall, I felt good this morning, had good breakfast. I'm looking forward to today because it's supposed to be here in the 50s. And maybe even touch 60, and so I'm going to do a little work at one of my remaining client, doing my accounting work for my nonprofit Center for Humans and Nature. So I'm looking forward to a good day.
Right.
And so far so good. I mean, I've held up pretty well, being on an ileostomy bag because of my rectal cancer and awaiting the recovery of my of the rectum. Before I move on and get reattached. Fact is that here I'm still learning on how to work with the bag, and it's the problem, my immediate reaction when I started all this was, gee, this is going to be difficult to replace and do this and do that. The challenge is to find the right product. There are so many products out there that so many different variations on what you can do in terms of it. And I would say that today is a continuation of finding something that's relatively successful in terms of how it fits, et cetera. So I'm feeling good. I'm going to be replacing my bag later today, solo, without my home care nurse coming in. So, but I feel very good about the way it's holding up. Usually, you change them every 3 to 4 days, so that's been real good too. So.
Yeah. Would you say you're ready to endorse what you got there?
Well, yeah. You see, I'm actually working with company, Hollister is the name of it. But they're the main one, and I, I've been trying to branch out because there are just so many different things. I mean, it's nice. I've got a woman at Hollister who calls me every couple of weeks asking how things are going and willing to send me samples of stuff based upon what the ostomy nurses, the ones who basically specialize in caring for individuals who are, have either colonoscopies or in my case an ileostomy, which is, you know, where it's connected to the small intestine rather than the colonoscopy is connected with the large intestine. I'm still in the middle. No, I wouldn't call it the middle, but towards the end. I've got a couple things I need to do. I'm going to try another bag today and see how that works. Part of the challenge is that I've got a slight hernia on the side of my, on the side of where the stoma, which is the output where the output comes out of. It's sort of, it's like my surgeon described it as he says it's a hernia. It's just, hey, part of your intestine just popped out, you know, and it's sitting there. And, you know, it's got a hole in it, and that's where it comes out.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, when you have these things happen to you, you think ahead of time, oh, my God, how am I going to deal with this? You hear your friends talk about it, and you go, oh, no, God. You know, but when you're in the middle of it, it's not like that at all.
No, I mean, we've, you know, here we are, we're with our common ailment being prostate cancer, and we've had to deal with the catheter, you much more than I have, but, you know, my surgery consisted of, I had surgery where I had both my prostate and my rectum taken out in one operation that took 9.5 hours. In your case, so I had both prostate cancer and rectum cancer, well, in your case, you've got a prostate cancer, and you've had to confront some of the things I have, and it's amazing how, particularly, I think the doggone catheter, it just drove me nuts when I thought about it, and it's amazing how you adapt, you learn how to work with things, and you're able to conduct your life and move on, to some extent. And that's what you've had to do, and I've had to do some extent,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I mean, it depends upon the circumstances that you enter into it, what the circumstances surrounding it are. In your case, it was very step-by-step, you know, on this day this is going to happen, that day that's going to happen. With me, it was like a medical emergency, you know.
Yes.
Suddenly, I
so
couldn't.
True.
Suddenly I couldn't pee. So my whole outlook on the catheter is my savior, the catheter, because I immediately felt like $1 million when he put that thing in there, and I emptied out my bladder of, you know, 2 liters of urine, and you can imagine what kind of distress I was in. And so it was, from that point forward, you know, I was just, how do I work with this thing? What do I need to do? I love it. It's great. And then, you know, from that point forward, I just, every little thing that it could do that was convenient, you know, I just, in my mind, I amplified it. And every little inconvenience, I just said, oh, well, you know, I'll work that out as time goes on. I'll try something else. I'll talk to my urologist. I'll experiment, whatever. But, yeah, it was just, like, totally wonderful. And just, yeah, oh, great. I don't have to get up to pee. Oh, super. I don't have to get to pee at night, you know, because you got this big bag. So,
yeah
it pretty amazing, pretty amazing what the human being is how adaptable one gets with these situations. And I think it's important for, I know you and I, we get a lot of talking to each other about this stuff, and innocent bystanders like our mother and our brother, Jeff, you know, mom's pretty, she's got a strong stomach, you know, Jeff just can't hear this stuff. Oh, he's got to get off the phone, right?
Yeah, well, you know, the thing is, you're absolutely right about, you were confronted with a emergency type need to address your inability to urinate. My situation is one where, you know, I go in and get a checkup, this or that, and before you know it, my exposure to a catheter is one that I was so ignorant that I didn't even realize I was going to have a catheter put in when I had my prostate biopsy to really check as to whether I had prostate cancer or not. I wake up and I find out that I feel something uncomfortable and realize that I have a catheter, and that was my exposure to it. And you know, of course, later on when I did have my prostate taken out, I had to have a catheter for a couple of weeks, and then we were more in tune in terms of our situations were more, the experiences were somewhat similar, although, you know, yours is is on a whole nother level. But at least, you know,
right.
I had some appreciation for some of the challenges and the things that you were going through, and we could kind of talk together and learn a little bit about each other's experience and build upon that, which was really good. So
yeah, I think it is too. I encourage anyone who has these things, if you feel comfortable talking, it doesn't even have to be someone with the same exact thing. It just has to be someone who doesn't get sick and try to get you to talk about something else, because you have to do a certain amount of talking about this stuff. It's how you process. There's some stage you go through with these things, and I don't know what you'd call it, but you know, you do need to talk out loud about it. And my general experience is, I can talk to women a lot easier than I can talk to men about what I'm going through, because every woman who has a child, usually, or a lot of them, get catheterized. And not just that, but, you know, the whole process of having a child, you go through a medical emergency, let's face it. You know, there's something, and they have a stronger stomach for blood and gore, not to cast dispersions on the female sex or anything like that, but, you know, let's just face it, you know, they deal with a lot more of that than men ever do. And also, you know, we're talking about penises here, you know, and that's like a sacred thing for men. You know, it's, you know, they don't want to hear about anything that could jeopardize that, you know.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, the thing is that right now, so you're still working with a catheter as you go through your treatment, and your treatment being the hormone therapy versus my treatment being the
removal.
Hormone therapy removal. And then after that, seeing, you know, particularly, you know, having both together, the remainder of my treatment is going to be primarily for the rectum, and it'll be chemotherapy, that I'll get after, you know, after things are pretty well healed up. So my ileostomy is temporary, but that doesn't, you know, I'm going to be having this ileostomy for, you know, 4 or 5 months. And so you're in a case where you're going to have your catheter for an extended period. And here I am, I'm with an ileostomy that is going to be for an extended period. So as a result, we have some commonality in the fact that we have these unusual things with terms of our body that we have to relate to, and we're every day, and we can talk about and learn from each other. And that, and even though they're not the same, there's so many things that are helpful in terms of what you do with these situations.
Yeah, coping mechanisms.
Yeah.
Attachment, placement, clothing, there's a lot of things, actually.
Yeah. I don't
feel to realize it.
Yeah, and it's, you know, you there's how much, and it's a sense with me of, well, how much of this is really, discomfort that I shouldn't have versus, let's face it, you know, there's some discomfort I probably should have. And how much of that is, you know, is to be expected, and how much should, you know, you have to address in terms of making better. And I'm in the process of working through that. It's sort of like people ask you, well, how do you feel? Well, let me share how I feel.
Loaded question.
Before I had, how did I felt before I had all this stuff? Do you want me to explain to how I feel now that I'm recovering? And so, you know, what I'm going to be in the future, I don't necessarily know. You know, what is 100%? I'll strive to do the best I can, but I don't necessarily know what that is yet.
And nobody does. I mean, that's the situation with me too, is that, you know, I was just told, hey, look, no two stage 4 prostate cancer situations are the same. And so don't compare yourself to other people. And, you know, you've got to work through this the way you work through it, and I'll be there with you, the doctor says, and, you know, we'll just go ahead and do it. And it's interesting, the difference, you're stage 2A, is that right?
Stage 2A on both.
Okay.
On both rectum.
Yeah,
and
prostate. And I've only got one cancer, and it's stage four, and which simply means that it spread. It's metastasized into other areas. Now, because of that, my treatment has to be, in a sense, radically different than yours. Yeah, there's no removal. Everybody always asks me this. Well, why don't they just remove it? I said, well, they'll never get it all. And, you know, it's dangerous, and there's no sense in doing it. So, well, what are you doing? You know, well, they have me on androgen deprivation. And it turns out that, you know, for reasons no one seems to know, you know, that prostate cancer and low amounts of androgen, which is a byproduct of testosterone, don't mix. And so you're going to see your prostate cancer disappear. And it all sounds very mystical and weird. And, you know, there's a lot written about it, and they use a lot of words to try and legitimize it. But basically, they don't really know why that therapy works. And I did a looking into it, and, you know, it turns out in Israel, I believe it was, they did some trials, and instead of taking out the testosterone, they put massive amounts in. And it had the same effect, if not better. So my current theory is, and this sounds really stupid, but you know how it is. You come up with these things in your head to get through the night sometimes. My current theory is that in my case, removal is not an option. So what I have to do is I have to trick my cancer. I'm starting to think about my cancer as like a separate person inside of me. And my doctor kind of reinforced this. He said, yeah, that's helpful. It is like that. I said, okay. I said, so it's like a separate person. I'm going to hide from it. It's looking for a man, a male. And so what's happened is I've altered the amount of testosterone I have in my body. So now it's confused. And it doesn't quite know where to go next. And it's just losing its wits and you know, imploding a little bit. It's going. We don't know where it's going or what's happening to it, but it's not showing up. You know, it's not on the scans. The organs that were affected are you know, getting better. You know, the area around my ureter that had a growth around it, gone. You know, the stuff in my spine, gone. You know, the swelling may have gone down a little bit. We'll find out how much. But yeah, so I think the strategy, you know, is so radically different in the two that it's kind of amazing, to the point where, you know, people have had prostate cancer and they're stage one or two and they've had removal or radiation or something, and they hear about what I'm doing, they think I'm out of my mind.
Well, yeah, I'll just conclude with respect to the way this discussion of cancer by my prostate cancer. Well, actually, this will be my rectum cancer. I go in and I ask my radiologist, as I'm getting all this radiation for my rectum cancer, and I said, how come we're doing all this radiation now rather than doing it after we get the rectum removed? And I said, what's the reason? And he said, because that works. That gives the better result. We know through experience. How it works, we don't know. But the end result is that you have a better chance of surviving if you get the radiation before. And the other thing that happened was I asked him, I said, well, how are we doing with respect to the radiation and how it's working? And he says, I don't know. He says, I don't know how you are doing specifically. I can just tell you that we know through experience that this is the most effective treatment. So it's exactly what you said. We've got these treatments, but don't try to get any, you know, explanations of how come they work. We just know that they work.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of amazing. You know, I develop software, and if I did it that way, I'd be in big trouble.
Yeah, trial and error. Well, you know, jeez.
Yeah. Yeah, so, we're gonna tune up the engine on the car while it's running.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I don't think so. Yeah. So, anyways.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. Well. Yeah. That's always an interesting topic. This stuff.
Well, I'll tell you what. You know, we've talked to medicine. We've talked a little baseball. We're just gonna have to probably we could, as a tease, we should we could talk a lot about Donald Trump, but we just don't have enough time for that right now, particularly after yesterday's press conference, which was more like you'd see after a wrestling match and see a professional wrestler being interviewed, is what it reminded me of. But we can leave that for another day. But that's definitely fodder that is out
there. Yeah, I agree.
That can be chewed on a lot.
Well, yeah, the only thing I'd say is that just observations from afar. Twitter, which I'm on pretty frequently, but a few times a day maybe, after that press conference, it was kind of like Twitter OD'd on sugar and caffeine and then lit its hair on fire. I'd never seen so much crazy on Twitter. People are really worked up about this stuff. And never heard so much talk about impeachment and all that stuff as yesterday afternoon. That was something.
Yeah,
like
you
said,
think
we'll leave that for another time.
Yeah, I do believe so. That'll make an interesting conversation, needless to say. So.
Yeah, absolutely. So where are we time-wise? Oh, we got 36 minutes.
Yep.
You got a quick one? Let's hear it. What do you got?
Well, no, not too much really to report. I'm going to, like I said before, I'll tell you what's amazing to me is how I watch weather and see disasters to the East Coast, disasters on the West Coast, and here I am sitting in Chicago, which most people would not want to be in January and February, and I'm enjoying weather that is going to be through Wednesday. It's going to be in the 60s, highs in the 60s, so I'm not going to try to explain it. I'm just going to enjoy it. It's about all I can say, but it's just kind of mind-boggling.
Well, and the last few years we've had the same experience in Austin. You know, we're known for our severe weather in the summer. Long stretches of temperatures over 100. We're known for, are these guys going to have enough water? You know, that kind of stuff. Last few years it's been the antithesis of that, and I look around and in some areas of the country that are north. So pretty nice.
Well,
low 70s, high 60s, something like that. How about you?
Well, right now, I'm sitting at about 40. It's supposed to get up to high 50s, and then the weekend is going to be record-breaking temperatures probably on Saturday, Sunday, and it's going to continue to be relatively mild in at least the high 50s through Wednesday. And even when it sort of starts to subside somewhat, it's going to be still way above average. I have this thing about, out now in Northern California, there was a big deal about the fact that a couple years ago, I mean, these guys were on severe water restriction. And my question is, could somebody officially announce when the drought is over in Northern California?
Yeah. Well, that whole thing's changed. Now we got this whole situation with that dam
Yeah. And,
Oroville?
One more brief comment on that is my closest friend lives in Monterey, California, and he lives up in the hills a little bit above the city, and his house is just surrounded by these very large trees. And I'll tell you, about maybe a month ago, one of those trees, it just, because the soil had been so saturated with moisture and the roots weren't that deep, the tree just falls over, and it just barely missed his house.
Wow.
So, yeah, there's it's pretty dangerous out there on many fronts. Mudslides, water, trees, you name it. There's a lot going on out there.
Yeah, I guess there is. And, California has kicked up a lot of dust. That's another political discussion, too, by the way. They are acting like they're going to secede from the union or some damn thing. They're getting really worked up.
I thought that was Texas that was going to do that.
Yeah, you'd think. think we got the reputation of that. People in Texas believe that they have the legal right to do that. But no, it's sounding more and more like California wants to do its own thing.
Wow.
Anyways, like you said, another discussion.
Well, you
Illinois
isn't going to succeed. They're going to get kicked out of the union.
Because of their budget. because the budget,
violence,
scandals,
everything. Yeah.
The crime.
Okay.
Oh, man.
Pretty good.
We live in some strange times. Well, yeah, so I'll just close in saying that we got a T-shirt. Just go to thebro.show in your browser. Just type, you know, thebro.show. And, yeah, you'll see our T-shirt. We got a T-shirt for sale. All funds toward Jerry's Cancer Fund. Yeah, and that'd be very helpful. Yeah, so, yeah, you guys enjoy. Have a good one. And,
okay.
John, you do the same. I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Sounds good. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Bye.